It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. While our physical school buildings are closed, school is in session on Talk of Iowa. On Tuesdays, we're learning about biology, and on Thursdays, Iowa history. This Thursday, we'll learn about Iowa during World War II. Right now, life on Earth is plentiful and incredibly diverse. Think for just a couple of minutes about the many species of animals and plants that you know about. Then, understand that there are billions, yes, literally billions of organisms you don't know about. The diversity of life on Earth is the result of evolution. This hour, we're going to learn the basics of evolution with Maureen Neiman, Associate Professor of Biology at the University of Iowa. Hello, Maureen.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. Jim Colbert is also here, Associate Professor of Biology at Iowa State University. Hello, Jim.
Hello. Hi, Charity. Thanks for including me. Well, pleasure to be here.
Wonderful to have you here. We've got a Hawkeye and two Cyclones on the air today, so I think we should be able to get a whole lot accomplished. And Jim, I'm going to let you go first. Give us a basic definition of evolution.
Well, evolution, when it boils down to it, is it's the explanation for why we have all the diversity of life that we have. And in essence, it boils down to organisms have different genetic information. Some of those individuals are better adapted, better suited to a particular environment. And those individuals are the ones that are most likely to survive long enough to reproduce. And in essence, that's how it works.
All right. So biology, evolution explains the diversity of life. It doesn't explain the origin of life, right?
That's a really interesting question, Charity, and it's actually a really common misconception. I've taught introductory biology here at Iowa State for somewhere around 30 years, and have taught evolution to many classes of students. And I've asked them this question, what do they think evolution explains? And about two-thirds of my students, when they enter the class, they think that evolution explains the origin of life, how life began. But in fact, the theory of evolution does not explain the origin of life. What it does is explain how, once life originated, it became very diverse. The origin of life is a really interesting question, and as a biologist and a scientist, I sure wish we had a well-supported theory that explained that, but we don't. That doesn't mean people aren't working on it. They are. It's a really interesting question, a really important question. It has impacts on things like, is there life anywhere else in our solar system or anywhere else in our galaxy? But bottom line is, right now we don't know, which, of course, for scientists is very exciting. We're always interested in things we don't know and trying to figure those things out.
Maureen, so let's talk about evolution in a little more detail. We know basically that it is change over time. It explains the diversity of life on Earth. What are some other elements of evolution that we really need to know?
Evolution is happening all the time. So I think often humans assume that evolution is something that happens once in a while or only happens under special circumstances. But one truism of evolution is that virtually every natural population, including humans, all the time is evolving. So evolution is constant. As Jim pointed out clearly, evolution represents change. And evolution does represent the source of all adaptation, so all the wonderful and incredible ways that organisms fit to their environment, take advantage of their environment and each other. But evolution is the source of all diversity, which means that it's also the reason why we have all sorts of weird and even bad traits as well. So we can blame evolution for our problems, along with crediting evolution for a lot of the wonderful elements of life.
Well, let's pick a species and try to understand how evolution might work in those species. And I think perhaps we should pick finches, because Charles Darwin chose finches to help us understand evolution and to help him understand evolution. So, James, why don't you tell us a little bit about Darwin's finches?
Well, Darwin had a remarkable, I guess I'll call it an internship, after he finished his undergraduate program. Traveled around the world, spent 5 years doing it. Absolutely incredible. I spent a lot of time in various parts of South America, but part of what he did was visit the Galapagos Islands off the west coast of South America. And while he was there, as was his job on the expedition, he was collecting various kinds of animals, plants, fossils, etc. Those were sent back to England. And on the Galapagos Islands, he collected a lot of bird specimens. And these birds had different shapes, different morphologies. They had different things that they ate. And he didn't necessarily really know exactly what they were. But when he got the specimens back to England and got there himself and started talking with experts on birds, what he learned was that all of these birds were types of finches, which was very surprising to him. So in the end, what's thought to have happened is there were, you know, one or maybe a couple of finch species that managed to get from mainland South America to the Galapagos Islands. And what they found there was a wide range of different types of habitats. And through time and through the process of evolution, those originating finches diverged and evolved to have different adaptations that allowed them to become these different kinds of species. So it was really a remarkable opportunity that he was there at that time and was able to do all that collecting and then analyze those later, and certainly was an important part of him developing the theory of evolution by natural selection.
Well, and Maureen, you mentioned earlier that adaptation isn't always positive, and we'll talk more about some of the myths of evolution in a moment, but help us understand how natural selection works, because it's not as cut and dried as I think a lot of us want it to be.
Yeah, the finch is actually a really, really nice example of natural selection and how it works, as well as a perfect opportunity for evolution being constant and happening now. So Darwin finches are being studied, you know, through today as an incredible example of evolution by natural selection in nature. And there's this two of the most lovely human beings that I've ever met, Rosemary and Peter Grant at Princeton University, have been studying Darwin's finches in the Galapagos for the last, I don't know, 40 or 50 years. They're in their 80s. They still study them. And I can put out a little plug for our terrific Iowa City Darwin Day events. If anyone here is interested in learning more about evolution, we put on these events in the winter near Darwin's birthday of February 12th. And Rosemary and Peter Grant came here, talked about these finches in 2017, and they told us about how these finches in, I think it was 1977, there was a terrible drought in the Galapagos Islands. And some of the finches had little beaks, and little beaks are good for eating little seeds. And some of the finches had big beaks, and big beaks are good for eating big seeds. And in this year of drought, all of the little seed plants died. And so only those finches with big beaks survived. And it turned out that there are genes that give finches bigger beaks and different variants of those genes that give finches littler beaks. And so those big beaked birds had little bird babies with bigger beaks. And those bigger beaked birds in the next generation were the ones who were much more prevalent than the small beaked birds. But what's so tricky about natural selection and what's just so complicated about our planet is that the next year was a really wet one. So the next year, the big beak birds were at a disadvantage because those big seed plants were no longer so common, so the direction of natural selection switched entirely. So all of a sudden, having a big beak was bad. So all the natural selection does is increase fit to a particular environment. It can't look ahead. It can't look to the future, which is probably a major reason why all sorts of organisms, including ourselves, have traits that maybe were good in the past but are not necessarily so good today.
Well, another example that I know that I'm sure both of you have taught and learned once upon a time when you were students in a biology class in high school is the example of the peppered moth. And this is a moth that lived in England, and it was very well suited to its environment until it wasn't. Maureen, do you want to give us the lesson of the peppered moth?
Yeah, so the peppered moth is this British moth that I think peppered is a really apt description. It's kind of got white wings with little black speckles. And it turns out that those wings are very hard to see when this moth is sitting on a tree that has light bark, like a birch tree, something like that. And so there were all sorts of these light bark trees in the United Kingdom before the Industrial Revolution when the air was clean. And these light-winged moths did better than darker-winged moths because birds that ate them couldn't see the light-winged moths against the light bark trees. But then the Industrial Revolution happened, so all sorts of machines appeared that were burning coal and pumping black particles into the air, and those black particles stuck to the tree bark, and trees could turn darker. So all of a sudden, those light-winged moths really stood out on the dark bark. But a rare moth that had inherited a mutation that made its wings darker couldn't be seen by the birds that like to eat those moths. And so those moths then suddenly did better than the light-winged moths. And if they were able to pass that mutation that made dark wings down to their moth babies, then the dark wings could spread through the population. So as long as the trees stayed dark, that's a good thing. But thankfully, humans figured out that maybe burning coal and sending it to the atmosphere all the time isn't necessarily a good thing. And so there was some effort to clean up the air. Trees got lighter again, and the direction of selection, which kind of moths it favored, switched back again to the lighter colored moths. So another good example, Charity, indeed, of how natural selection isn't always in the same direction, or certainly can't make any predictions about the future.
And we're going to have to take a break here in just a moment. But Jim, we were talking earlier about how evolution does not explain the origin of life. It explains the origin of species, which, of course, Charles Darwin wrote about in his very, very famous publication over 160 years ago. But evolution also tells us that all species on Earth are descended from a single common ancestor.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, and one that I often try to make to my students. One of the great things about evolution is whenever you go anywhere, you are surrounded by your relatives. It's like going to a family reunion. You go outside, and you've got fungi, and you've got plants, and you've got bats, and you've got bunnies. Somewhere back in time, we're all connected.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. School is in session on Talk of Iowa today. We are learning about evolution. And with me, Jim Colbert, Associate Professor of Biology at Iowa State University, Maureen Neiman, Associate Professor of Biology at the University of Iowa. And of course, you are welcome to join the conversation. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are learning about evolution. School is in session on Talk of Iowa. For the past few weeks, every Tuesday, we've been learning about animals, wildlife, biology. And on Thursdays, we dig into Iowa history. This Thursday, we're going to learn about Iowa during World War II. Today, it's Evolution 101 with Maureen Neiman, Associate Professor of Biology at the University of Iowa, and Jim Colbert, Associate Professor of Biology at Iowa State University. And we've been talking about what evolution is. Now I want to talk a little bit about what evolution isn't, because people who believe that they understand evolution pretty well have some common misconceptions about evolution and how it works. So, Maureen, I'll let you go first on this. What do you want people to know that evolution is not?
Evolution is not purposeful. So evolution doesn't have a goal in mind. The fancy word that philosophers use is teleological, but the simple definition of that is goal-oriented. So evolution doesn't have a goal. It doesn't have a purpose. Evolution is change, and that's all. So what that means is that, contrary to kind of common misconception, evolution is not always positive. Evolution can have consequences for organisms that are negative. It can have consequences for organisms that reduce complexity. So they confuse evolution with progress. But again, evolution is not goal-directed, not always about increasing adaptations. So evolution is maybe simpler than what people presume it to be.
That's interesting, because I know that I get really fascinated and excited about creatures that have really bizarre and cool evolutionary adaptations. And some of them have so many crazy evolutionary adaptations. My son and I were just watching a video about the mantis shrimp the other day that is uniquely suited to its environment and completely bizarre, completely different from every other creature on Earth. But that's not necessarily the direction that evolution is always headed. It worked for the mantis shrimp, but simplicity is sometimes a better way to survive and procreate, right?
Absolutely. I mean, there's examples of organisms that have lost traits that we kind of assume, I was about to use the word blindly, which is funny because I was going to talk about the evolutionary loss of eyes, but we assume that it's always good to have eyes, for example. But organisms like the blind cave crayfish, have lost eyes over the course of evolutionary history. So it isn't, we don't necessarily always infer that losing eyes is good, but it seems like at least it hasn't always been bad. So evolution can certainly surprise us.
Now, Jim, I've mentioned Charles Darwin already, and of course, Darwin comes up in any conversation about evolution, but that's one of the myths, too, that this is one man's idea, right?
Well, that is a common misconception. It's actually a really interesting story, and I encourage your listeners to Google Alfred Russel Wallace sometime and learn about a person who was incredibly motivated and incredibly tough to do what he did. But it turns out that pretty much at the same time, Charles Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace came up with the same idea of evolution by natural selection. In fact, Charles received a letter from Alfred Russel Wallace basically saying, gee, I have this idea. What do you think about it? And he realized that he was about to get scooped. So they sort of published some things together. But anyway, the point is it's not just one man's idea. And since that time, Darwin and Wallace certainly did not understand everything or know everything about evolution. Since that time, there have been many, many scientists, biologists in particular. Maureen is one of those people who are actively studying evolution, trying to help us understand it better. So I think the important thing to understand is that Darwin and Wallace started our understanding of evolution. They certainly did not finish our understanding of evolution. We're still in the process of doing that today.
Well, and the fact that two people at approximately the same time were observing changes in nature that led them to start to understand this process, of course, that was a confirmation for both of them at that time as well. And you mentioned, you know, over time, many, many scientists have studied evolution and have found a great deal of evidence that supports evolution. Some people who don't believe in evolution will say, but it's just a theory. So, Jim, I would love to hear your response to that.
So thank you for asking that question, Charity. That's awesome. Yeah, so what it really boils down to is a couple of things, a couple of misunderstandings. First of all, the word theory, like a lot of words, can have more than one meaning. And in everyday life, when we say theory, we basically mean it's a guess. I mean, I can say my theory is it's going to be sunny and 90 degrees out today, but of course, we just heard the weather forecast, and it's not. So in science, theory has a much different definition. In science, what a theory is, it's our very best explanation that's based on all the available facts and all the available information. So that's one piece of the misconception. The second is people will often say, well, if evolution was, you know, really well established, it wouldn't be a theory, it would be a law, or it would be a fact. And the problem with that is that those are really different things. Theories don't become laws ever. Theories incorporate whatever laws are relevant. Theories don't become facts. They incorporate all the facts in science. So to say that, you know, evolution is just a theory and therefore we can, you know, sort of dismiss it is really a fundamental misunderstanding of what theory means in science. In fact, the theory of evolution is one of the very best supported theories in science, in our understanding of the natural world. And if you want a good analogy, just recognize that gravity is also a theory. But I wouldn't be stepping off the edge of any tall buildings.
No, not one you really want to question. Maureen, maybe you can give us a little bit of insight. As Jim was saying, of course, scientists are still studying evolution. You are an evolutionary biologist, and we have in the past talked about your research on this program. So if people want to look up your name on our website, they can really dig into some of the work you've done with snails. But give us a broader look at what an evolutionary biologist does in 2020.
Yeah, it's such a good question. And what we do is incredibly diverse. There are evolutionary biologists like me who love going out into nature and generating the data and making the observations and doing the experiments that we need to understand the diversity that exists in nature around us. So my fascination is why organisms use sexual reproduction to make offspring instead of just cloning themselves, which there are many reasons to believe that we should all just be girls and women and females who just make genetic copies of ourselves, but we don't. So this huge question exists, and I go out in nature and study these snails that live in New Zealand, but I also come back to my lab and sequence the genomes of these snails and look for mutations that might help explain why being sexual is an advantage over being asexual. Other people study other organisms in nature, or they use laboratory model organisms like fruit flies and little worms and little plants that are easy to grow and easy to manipulate. And other people use math and computational tools to come up with theoretical predictions for what evolution should look like under certain conditions, or to delineate conditions under which evolution should proceed in a particular manner. And then that allows experimental and data-driven scientists like myself to then design the studies that we need to determine whether these specific expectations are met. So it's very diverse. We study everything, you know, from our own selves, so they're evolutionary biologists who study humans, all the way down to the evolutionary biologists who study viruses and bacteria, or who use computers and equations.
Well, and you mentioned reproduction, and of course that is looking at evolution. That is our role on Earth, is to reproduce and have our genes successfully go forward. Now, of course, as humans, we have a lot of other things that we think about our purpose on Earth, about the meaning of our lives. But for an evolutionary biologist, that's pretty much the basic definition of success, right? That a species can reproduce and their genes will move forward.
Well, that's a really interesting point, because there are all sorts of organisms that don't make it quite that simple. Darwin was actually really puzzled by the ants, bees, and wasps, which is a group of organisms that we call Hymenoptera, so it's a group of insects. And these are fascinating organisms in that what we call the workers sacrifice their own opportunities to make their own babies to help a queen, often but not always a close relative like a sister, make her own babies. So there are organisms that actually depart quite strikingly from these patterns, and they present really incredible test cases for evolutionary biologists to use to understand how and why evolution works the way that it does.
We are talking about evolution this hour on Talk of Iowa. With me, Maureen Niemann, Associate Professor of Biology at the University of Iowa, and Jim Colbert, Associate Professor of Biology at Iowa State University. And another one of the myths that we want to talk about here is the idea that the evolutionary process is always very slow. And of course, in many species, Jim, evolution is a slow process, but that is not always the case, right?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, and it's another one my introductory biology students often ask me. And the real answer to this question boils down to how quickly does the species reproduce? So organisms like ourselves that, you know, produce the next generation maybe roughly every 20 years or something like that, the overall process of evolution is pretty slow. It takes thousands of years to see big changes. But for other organisms, some of which Maureen's already mentioned, for example, bacteria that can reproduce as quickly as every 20 minutes, they can show dramatic evolutionary changes in a really short period of time. So evolution, as Maureen said, is happening all the time, but the rate at which you see big changes accumulate depends on how rapidly the species reproduces. And we have everything from, you know, very quickly reproducing things like viruses or bacteria to things like elephants that reproduce very, very slowly. So the rate of evolution is going to vary depending on that.
We have an email from Stephanie, and she's asking the two of you to discuss the possible Arabic origins of what we understand as evolution. She says, I know that the history of the area and time, roughly 1,000 years before Darwin's time, is hazy, but Al-Jahiz wrote an encyclopedia that discussed some of the processes that would later be understood as evolutionary theory. Have you heard about this part of history or possibility, Maureen?
You know, I really appreciate that point. When I teach my evolution class, I begin the course with a history of evolutionary thinking, and I always qualify it by saying that this is focused specifically on a set of Western thinkers that we know about in our Western society. And I am not well-versed, honestly, in ideas that come from those sort of traditional sources of information. So it sounds like something that I should check out and think about whether it's relevant to include the next time around.
Let's go to the phones. John is on the line in the Quad Cities. Hi, John.
Hi. I wondered how to present this thing to you. I wondered about how is genetic sequence of lineage determined? The mechanics of how do you determine which generation came after the other, after the other, after the other?
Maureen?
It's a really good question. It's a really important question from a methodological perspective. So how do we use DNA information to reconstruct the relationships between different lineages or populations? And the answer is that we use a framework in evolution that's called phylogenetics, where we make assumptions that are usually well informed by data for how and why particular mutational changes will occur, the likelihood of those changes and how often those changes will happen. And then we typically will use those ideas to infer that species that share more of their DNA sequence have been related more recently, that they've shared a common ancestor more recently than species in which the DNA sequences are more different.
Well, John, thank you so much for that question. Before the show, I asked both of you to come up with some examples of evolutionary adaptations that you wanted to talk about. And Maureen, you had mentioned a couple of times that evolution is not always positive. We are not always seeing improvements from generation to generation. And I know you have a couple of examples of evolutionary adaptations that are either useless or actually bad. Give us an example.
Well, maybe my favorite and most obvious example of what seems like a useless trait, and I mean, I can recognize that this conversation could spin off in directions I don't want it to, but men have nipples. And at least from a functional perspective, there's no apparent reason why men have nipples. They don't use them to feed offspring, which is the ostensible purpose of nipples in the female version of mammalian species. So the simple explanation for why men have nipples is that men and women, or male and female mammals, share the same genome. We have the same genetic information that makes us into organisms. And evolution by natural selection has very strongly favored female mammals that have nipples that can use those nipples to feed babies with milk. It turns out that if the girls are going to have nipples, then the boys do too. So they're just there, and you have to put Band-Aids on them when you run, say, and you know maybe they're even worse than useless. But they certainly do not have an obvious adaptive function on the male side.
Absolutely. Well, and Jim, I'm sorry, we're coming right up on a break again, so you've got about a minute here. But you had a kind of moss that you want to talk about. You can start it at least. We can talk more after the break too.
So there's many different adaptations that are really amazing that one could talk about. But I knew that that Maureen was interested in sexual reproduction and so forth. And so one of the things I'm interested in are mosses. And people probably know that, you know, mosses are short, tiny little plants. But not all mosses. Some mosses have separate male and female individuals. And a particular group of mosses that's called the broom mosses, the males are tiny. They are dwarfs. They actually live on the females. So this works really well when the males produce sperm. They're right next to where the females produce eggs. But it's a really interesting question. How did this adaptation evolve? And it's also interesting in that only a relatively small number of mosses have this adaptation. Most do not have that adaptation. So, yeah, there's a lot of really wild and weird things that evolution has produced.
Absolutely. Well, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me, Jim Colbert, Associate Professor of Biology at Iowa State University, Maureen Neiman, Associate Professor of Biology at the University of Iowa, and we're learning about evolution this hour. You are welcome to join the conversation with your questions, 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can also email Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. School is in session on Talk of Iowa this hour. We are learning about evolution. And you can also go to our website, iowapublicradio.org. We have a web post about this show that includes vocabulary words, some discussion questions, a link to an interesting video that you might want to watch if you want to explore more about evolution at home. On Thursday, school will be in session again. We're going to learn about Iowa during World War II. My guests this hour are Maureen Neiman, Associate Professor of Biology at the University of Iowa, and Jim Colbert, Associate Professor of Biology at Iowa State University. And just before the break, we were talking about some unusual adaptations. Maureen, you gave us an example of a possibly useless adaptation, but also there are things that are really detrimental that have evolved. And one of those examples is allergies, right?
Yeah. So right now at this time of year is probably when a lot of us are feeling these things called allergies, which is essentially an immune over-response to some sort of non-harmful thing in our environment, like pollen. I think, and now we're probably all feeling extra self-conscious about our allergies because sneezing and coughing in public is not very popular right now. So the allergies that we get are the consequence of an incredibly important adaptation that we have, which is this immune system that fights off these bacteria and viruses that are constantly attacking us. But sometimes our immune system can confuse something like tree pollen or dust as something dangerous when it's not. And so our immune system makes us feel miserable because it's fighting against something that's not actually bad.
And yet, it doesn't get in the way of our ability to reproduce and pass those genes along, right?
Well, that's a really interesting point, too. I mean, there are people who die from immune hyper-responsive conditions. So I think that that is actually not necessarily the case. There's natural selection on humans all the time. And so if humans who have allergies are less likely to make babies, and if there are genes or genetic variants that mean that some people are more likely to have allergies than others and pass allergies on to their kids, we could see evolutionary changes in allergies over time that are a result of natural selection. And I know there's been some very interesting talk about, you know, why some people, and especially young people, get so sick with COVID-19 when others are basically asymptomatic. And there's a lot of interest in whether some of these people, these young people, might actually have these extra immune responses that actually can be bad and can even result in severe illness or death. So it's a complicated question.
Yeah. Jim, why do you think it's important to understand evolution? Why is this something that we need to study?
Well, excellent question, Charity. I think that my first answer to that is it's always better to know what's actually going on than to not know what's actually going on. And the reality is that humans and all the other species on Earth are products of evolution, and so it's important to understand that. But there's also some really practical aspects of this, and we've talked about it maybe a little bit already, but one of the things that your listeners are probably familiar with is the medical problem of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. And this is a serious problem. Antibiotics that in the past worked very well to cure particular infections and so forth. Now they don't work. And why is it that they're not working? And the answer to that question is evolution of the bacteria themselves. And it kind of comes back to something that Maureen was saying earlier about environments can change. So prior to, the 1940s or 50s, we didn't have antibiotics. We didn't use them. Sometime in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, they became very widely used. And so the way we should think about that is what we just did was dramatically change the environment that these bacteria are living in. And prior to use of antibiotics, it wasn't any benefit to the bacteria to be resistant to antibiotics, though some small percentage happened to carry the genes that were needed for that. Once we change the environment and we, you know, put out lots and lots of antibiotics into the environment, those bacteria that happen to have that particular genetic information became much more common. This is evolution. And what that means is today you're far more likely to contract an infection that is difficult to treat with antibiotics because those kind of antibiotic-resistant bacteria are now much more common, particularly in healthcare settings, particularly in hospitals and so forth. So understanding something about evolution is really important at a very basic level that has to do with human health.
Well, and some of the precautions that we're asked to take when we take antibiotics are an effort to stop that evolution, right? I mean, we need to understand how it works to try to prevent it from happening as well. And yeah. Maureen, I want to give you an opportunity to answer that question as well. Why do you think it's important for us to understand evolution?
Well, I think I'm going to go back initially to a point that Jim made, which is that we've all evolved from a common ancestor. And I view that as a very appealing, unifying sort of commonality to share across life. It brings us together as humans. All of us humans have shared a common ancestor really quite recently, likely within the last few hundred thousand years. So at least for me, and I think for many others, it makes us feel connected to one another, a compassion for one another. We're all relatives. So we all have things that we share that I think are important to consider. And then in understanding ourselves, so as humans, we've evolved. If we're going to understand our medical challenges, if we're going to understand our behavior, even our culture evolves. We have to understand the mechanisms by which this happens. So the hows and the whys are going to help us better understand ourselves. And I would hope help make life better for all people and for most people. You know, can we apply these ideas for the betterment of humanity? And Charles Darwin was actually very much motivated by thinking about concerns with respect to human inequities when he was working as an evolutionary biologist. And he was one of the very first of the first to say, hey, all humans have a common ancestor, which was an incredibly important conceptual leap forward to make.
I want to go to the phones. You are welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Linda is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I have questions about, I guess what I first wanted to ask is if in this conversation, is there a distinction between micro and macro evolution, adaptations of organisms versus one species becoming another species?
Okay, so we can tackle that first. Jim, do you want to tackle that?
Well, yeah, I can say a little bit about it. People talk about micro and macro evolution, but really a better way to think about it is a continuum. It's really all part of the same thing. Small changes, like changes in a particular gene over time, you could call that micro evolution. You can actually test that experimentally in the lab. Macroevolution is really just the accumulation of those changes over time. Perhaps an analogy that you might think about would be, rain falling on a hillside. And as that rain falls, it starts to remove, a few particles of soil. But you let that rain continue for a long time, lots of rain, many years, you now have a giant ravine. So the process of evolution is kind of like the process of erosion. It's the accumulation of small changes through time that lead eventually to big changes. And the best evidence we really have for macroevolution, obviously we have the current diversity of life on Earth, but we also have a hugely fascinating and robust fossil record that tells us there have been a tremendous range of species that have lived on Earth. And the species that are currently here are very different, at least many of them, are very different than what we had, you know, millions of years ago.
Linda, thank you so much for your call. And as we get close to the end of the hour, I want to talk about the coronavirus, the novel coronavirus, COVID-19, that is traveling through populations worldwide right now. And I know that neither one of you focuses your research on studying viruses, but the reason that this is relevant is because viruses do evolve. Maureen, do you want to start us off here? I mean, with COVID-19, understanding the evolution of a virus is extremely important.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think much of the story of this virus is actually one that's about evolution. We have every reason to believe that this particular strain of the virus has likely evolved in the context of bat colonies. So it's basically evolved to infect bats. And like many cases of these combinations of a virus with a host animal or plant, it doesn't make its host, in this case, the bats, its natural host, it doesn't make them very sick. Probably because this virus has adapted to its bat host in a way to maximize its transmission rate. So if a virus makes a bat super sick and the bat's like lying on the bottom of the cave not going anywhere, it's not going to be breeding that virus in other bats. But if a bat's not really sick and it's got the virus and it's flying around and like, you know, kissing other bats or whatever they do, then that virus is more likely to get transmitted. But this virus didn't evolve in humans, so when it jumped over to humans, all of a sudden the biology of the virus that works really well in bats is maladapted to humans, so it makes us sick, and maybe often because it makes our immune system kind of go crazy, or because our immune system just can't cope with it. So eventually, over time, evolution by natural selection could actually favor strains of COVID-19 that make us less sick, simply because those strains are more transmissible. Because I think as we've started to learn, if you don't have symptoms but you're infected by this virus, you can infect a lot more people than if you're lying at home in bed. So, and the other part of the viral evolution that's so important is that when we make vaccines, we make vaccines that are specifically designed to attack or to match a particular strain of a virus. Well, now because viruses evolve, if a virus's sequence has changed, the vaccine that we've designed might not be a very good match for the virus that's actually circulating. And we see this happen every single year with influenza. Luckily, influenza evolves a lot faster than the SARS-CoV-2 virus that causes COVID-19. So hopefully that provides some positive messaging with respect of our potential to develop an effective vaccine for this disease.
Well, and Jim, anything you want to add to that?
I think that all I could add to that is I am also not a virologist or immunologist, but Maureen's comments are right along my understanding as well. I mean, I think the best news about this virus is it does not seem to mutate and evolve as rapidly as influenza. And though it's too early to tell, that makes it more likely that an effective vaccine can be developed.
Well, and that is something that virologists and immunologists are looking for very carefully right now. I've seen several articles just in the last few weeks questioning, you know, if this is something that can reinfect us or if there is a new strain that is developing that can make people sick or sicker, that kind of thing. I mean, this is evolution in action, right, Maureen?
You got it. It's all about the evolution. Like, if this thing wasn't living, if this virus was some inert entity, we would probably not be so troubled by it. And diseases in general, if diseases weren't living, like they didn't evolve, it wouldn't be such a big deal. But because we're dealing with this constantly changing target, both our immune systems and now, you know, recently our ability to detect or to develop vaccines, we are constantly in this kind of arms race against these viruses and bacteria as well.
We have just a couple of minutes left, and I would love to hear from each of you. If people are listening right now and they want to learn more about evolution or see evolution in the world around them, Jim, can you give someone some advice about where to go next to explore and discover more?
Well, there's a wonderful evolution website that's run by the University of California, Berkeley, that has all kinds of information. That'd be a great place to start. But really, I think the other thing I would say is just look at the world around you. There's maple trees, but are they all exactly the same? And the answer is, if you look closely enough at them, they aren't. There's individual variation. That individual variation is a result of differences in genetics and also differences in the environment that they're growing in. But that's the raw material that evolution is working on. I think, you know, I would encourage people to, you know, remember this one thing about it, I guess. There's really only one way to stop evolution, and that's extinction. And that is exactly what we are trying to avoid for our species. And as a biologist, I hope for as many of the species that we share this planet with as possible.
Maureen, what about you? What do you think a next step should be for a curious learner?
I would echo what Jim said. I mean, when I was, you know, 6, 7, 8, I remember going outside and just finding things and that looked different and wondering about them. So Jim's maple trees, I would spend hours outside with those little helicopters doing races with the helicopters. And I would keep the helicopters that stayed in the air the longest, assuming that they were best. And then I would race them against other helicopters and eventually plant the maple seeds, and nothing ever happened. But variation is the evolutionary biologist's best friend. So right now, like, you can go out in Iowa City and there are some squirrels that are gray and some squirrels that are black and some, maybe even a white squirrel. And I think it's super interesting to think about, why are they these different colors? What do these different colors mean? Is it easier for a bird or a cat or something to see like a gray squirrel versus a black squirrel? Do I still see black squirrels if I go out in the forest? I mean, you just find variation, think about it, start asking questions about it. And that variation is absolutely everywhere.
Well, thank you both so much for being here today. Maureen Niemann, thank you.
Thank you. I've had a lot of fun.
Maureen Niemann is an associate professor of biology at the University of Iowa. Jim Colbert, thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. Great to talk with you, Maureen and Charity.
Jim Colbert is an associate professor of biology at Iowa State University, and you can find out more about evolution on our website, iowapublicradio.org. We have a post about this program, including vocabulary words and discussion questions as you discover more. And of course, there's a great deal more out there to discover. Again, school is in session on Thursday with our Iowa History program. We're going to explore the history of World War II in Iowa. And then next Tuesday, it's the last week of school. So next Tuesday, we're going to explore the ecosystems of Iowa for our final program of the school year. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.